The trial of a criminal kingpin today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Mexican drug lord El Chapo went on trial in Brooklyn today. Security is a huge concern, especially for the jury.
For example, a Michael Jackson impersonator was dismissed because they said he could be easily identified, and they're trying to keep the jury anonymous for their safety.
El Chapo could be looking at life in prison, but his drug and human trafficking cartel is still going strong.
They're still huge in cocaine. Heroin has been a huge boom for them because of the opioid epidemic in the United States. And then they've also added fentanyl to their portfolio.
How the Sinaloa cartel works with or without El Chapo. That's today, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. For a drug cartel kingpin, the nickname Shorty is a striking contrast to the crimes he's charged with. And now he's on trial. Joaquin El Chapo Guzman entered court today in New York City. He was once Mexico's most feared cartel leader, repeatedly escaped the grasp of Mexican authorities, and famously broke out of jail twice in Mexico. Remember the meticulously dug tunnel with its own rail system?
This is the closest that we've been allowed to get to El Chapo's tunnel, the tunnel he used in his brazen escape on Saturday night. It is, by all accounts, a magnificent feat of engineering. So let's come on in.
El Chapo was nabbed again in 2016 and extradited to the U.S. last year. He's now answering to a long list of crimes, including his Sinaloa drug cartel's deep reach into this country. The BBC's Neda Taufik is at the courthouse in Brooklyn. So just tell us what the scene was today as the trial got underway.
Well, this trial took place under heavy security. El Chapo Guzman is being held in solitary confinement in Lower Manhattan. And so every time that he's transferred here to the courthouse, the Brooklyn Bridge is shut down and a heavily armed motorcade brings him across the bridge. There is international media here because, of course, he is the world's most powerful drug lord who ran an international operation. And so this case has gotten a lot of attention.
So just remind us, what charges is Guzman facing and why is he being tried in the U.S. after escaping from a Mexican jail?
Well, he is facing a 17 criminal count indictment. The charges range from trafficking $14 billion worth of cocaine, heroin, and other drugs into the United States, as well as money laundering charges and weapon offenses. His indictment is really a consolidation of charges from across six different federal districts in the country, including New York, Chicago, Miami, all places that have been greatly affected by the drug trade.
Yeah, I heard, Neda, that jury selection was pretty difficult for this trial. Can you explain why?
Yeah, absolutely. I think underscoring just how complex this is, they had questionnaires sent to 1,000 people and they interviewed close to 100 people in person. Now, several of the juries expressed fear to serve. Others were just too easily identifiable. For example, a Michael Jackson impersonator was dismissed because they said he could be easily identified, and they're trying to keep the jury anonymous for their safety. Another person said he was a fan of El Chapo's and asked for an autograph, so he was promptly dismissed. And today, we had opening statements delayed because one woman who cried last week when she found out she was chosen had a doctor's note saying that she suffered several medical issues because she had been selected. And so the judge did decide to dismiss her, saying, you know, he was afraid that she could suffer a breakdown out of the anxiety she was feeling.
So far, the jurors have heard nothing.
That's right. You know, this is going to be a 4-month long trial. And so this certainly underscores how lengthy this all could be. But we know that prosecutors, for example, have hundreds of pages of documents, audio recordings from El Chapo discussing certain drug transactions. They say they have physical evidence like drug ledgers from Colombian cartel bosses where they detail their deals with El Chapo. And we know that they also have cooperating witnesses, including one of El Chapo's former lieutenants.
Did you catch a glance of El Chapo today, and what is his demeanor?
Well, Al Chapo came into court wearing a suit and tie. He briefly waved to his wife. And, you know, he is really kind of an unopposing figure in person. His nickname, El Chapo, means shorty because he is 5'6". He is known to be very charismatic in person. And that's one of the things that several of the defense attorneys and prosecutors mentioned.
The BBC's Neda Taufik outside the federal courthouse in Brooklyn, where El Chapo's trial got underway today. Let's shift focus to his drug trafficking empire. It's still doing brisk business, apparently.
My interviews and investigations suggest that business is still booming for the Sinaloa cartel.
Deborah Bonello is a journalist based in Mexico City. She specializes in organized crime in the Americas and has been looking at the Sinaloa cartel's operations since El Chapo was extradited to the U.S.
Heroin has been a huge boom for them because of the opioid epidemic in the United States and the fact that you have so many people switching from prescription painkillers to Mexican heroin. Methamphetamine is still a huge business for them. And then they've also added fentanyl to their portfolio.
It seems like part of the reason why the Sinaloa cartel has been able to thrive, even without El Chapo, is geography, so some people say. I know there are a lot of advantages to operating out of the state of Sinaloa. And just tell us about Sinaloa. Where exactly is it and what are the advantages?
Well, Sinaloa is a northern state that shares a border with the United States. Its southern part forms part of the Golden Triangle, which is the kind of the ripest cultivation in Mexico. So the climate lends itself to heroin and marijuana cultivation. Parts of Sinaloa are also very rural, so it's easier to nurture drug plant cultivation in those zones. And, you know, this legend of El Chapo in Sinaloa is no lie. You know, you speak to people, and for very many people, he is a kind of Robin Hood character, not so much stealing from the state, but providing jobs and buying the product of thousands of small-scale farmers there who are producing marijuana and poppy plants. So they're perceived as benefactors. And, you know, when there are floods and natural disasters, aid often turns up carrying logos and initials connected to El Chapo and El Mayo and other important people in the organization. So they have a very important social status, as well as the fact that that part of Mexico lends itself to cultivation and, of course, to transportation because it has that shared border with the U.S.
You also, in there, mentioned El Mayo. Remind us who he is.
Ismael El Mayo Zambada. I mean, he is, you know, another legendary drug kingpin. To my understanding, he is the only powerful person within the Sinaloa cartel who hasn't seen the inside of a jail cell. He is now sharing power with El Chapo's brother, as well as his sons. So you have a lot of different power factions now in what is an increasingly fragmented organization. But my understanding is that El Mayo is kind of sitting on top of that and, you know, refereeing in a way and making sure that things carry on running smoothly.
I know that in the past, El Chapo had been able to kind of run the Sinaloa cartel even from prison, kind of via remote control. Is that the case today?
One of the points of his extradition is that it takes away any influence he could have now. Being in a maximum security prison in the United States is very different from being in one in Mexico. So taking him to the United States in itself would have kind of shut that down, I think.
But. But are you certain that he's not pulling strings from his prison cell? I mean, he's a wily character, El Chapo.
He is, but I also think the bigger threats that we're seeing to the future of the Sinaloa cartel are not due to the arrest and extradition of El Chapo. You know, I think, you know, law enforcement would say, I'm sure that he had to pay for what he did, and that's great, but it has not had the organizational impact they were looking for. I think more of a threat now to Sinaloa are other rising criminal powers that you're seeing in Mexico. And I think a lot of the violence that we've seen, which is at an all-time high now in Mexico, is to do with conflict between organizations over leadership, territory, roots, and those kinds of things.
So, Deborah, from your perch in Mexico City, what would an El Chapo conviction actually do to the drug trade and violence?
I hate to say it, but very little. I think that it will set an important example to other people in the criminal underworld of where they may end up. But in terms of the day-to-day, I don't think an El Chapo conviction is going to have very much impact on what's happening in Mexico right now.
Deborah Bonello, a journalist and researcher based in Mexico City. Thank you very much, Deborah.
Great talking to you, Marco.
If you were with us 3 years ago today, you would have heard this.
France is in a state of emergency right now after multiple attacks in Paris this evening. We've been following this breaking news all this hour. Police in Paris say there are several people dead, but it's too early to say how many. And a hostage situation in a concert hall in the French capital is ongoing.
My colleague Jeb Sharp there with our coverage on the night of November 13th, 2015. ISIS militants had attacked multiple targets in Paris, killing 130 people. Most of the victims were inside that concert hall, the Bataclan. Fred DeVeild was there that night watching a concert by the Eagles of Death Metal. He first described his experience in an illustrated memoir called My Bataclan. Now he has a second book. It details his recovery. Emma Jacobs has his story.
In the opening pages of Fred DeVeild's latest graphic memoir, he arrives in the French countryside with his wife and children.
It was really a wish to be quiet for 3 weeks, with no Paris, no radio, no computers.
It was the summer of 2016 and his family's first real vacation since the attack at the Bataclan. DeVeild managed to survive that night by pretending to be dead. On holiday, he and his family walked in the woods, played cards, went on picnics, all recorded in detailed black and white drawings. Then, a few days into their stay,
I just switch on the radio in the car
to plug in his phone to play music.
And I heard France is in war.
The night before, an ISIS supporter had driven a truck through a crowd in Nice gathered to watch Bastille Day fireworks, killing 86 people.
After it's a shock, such big shock,
his memories came crashing back. DeVeild's new book is called Le Morsure, which translates as
the bite.
The night of the Bataclan attack in November 2015, he says, was like being bitten by a snake.
Poison me in my mind and in my heart, in my body.
For him, that snake represents fear and hate that linger. Throughout his graphic memoir, a black stain expands and contracts on his arm with the darkness of his mood. After Nice, the black stain grows and threatens to overwhelm him. When he spends time with his children, it recedes, but is always present. DeVeild compares life since he survived the Bataclan to living in an elevator.
One day is really fine, one day is awful. One night is crazy and we don't sleep. One night is absolutely marvelous.
Seemingly small things can trigger his fear and anxiety.
It can be something I saw on the TV, an emergency car passing in the streets. It can be a plane that I hear in the kitchen.
DeVeild, who is 51, worked as a medical illustrator for more than 20 years. But he has now spent 3 years on and off creating panels about the Bataclan and his life since then.
If you want to forget something, you have to work on it. It helps you to take distance.
This book took 2 years to complete. And even now, he still has violent nightmares.
It was always rifle attack.
But the nightmares don't come as often as they used to.
I think that drawing helped me. It's the only way to me explain the thing you are afraid of if you want to forget it.
He says his children have continued to help, too. His youngest is 6.
They don't care about in what mood you are. You don't want it, but Daddy, I want to go playing to the park. Okay, let's go to the park. And then going to the park, you hear a little bird singing. And, oh, yes, life is outside.
So he still has bad days.
But the more day now are good and the less day are bad.
He has also started work on a third book. For the world, I'm Emma Jacobs.
You can see some of the illustrations from Fred DeVeild's memoir. That's at theworld.org. And still ahead, she barely made it out of Paradise, California with her baby. How they're doing today. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Germany has a reputation as a clean energy leader. The country's use of renewable power, that is a big part of its effort to fight climate change. But there's another side to Germany's energy story. The country still burns a lot of coal. For years, it's put off a decision on when it should stop. Now the battle over coal in Germany is heating up, and the flashpoint is a forest. Valerie Hamilton has a story.
A few weeks ago, I got a voice message from a former colleague of mine who was out in the Hambacher Forest in western Germany. His name is Tobias, and he was spending the night in the woods with some climate activists. They'd been occupying the forest for years, and things were finally coming to a head.
Okay, Valerie, the police start attacking at night, people fighting back, lots of barricades. I was just in the middle of the fight.
The activists had been fighting for weeks with police trying to clear them out. It sounded intense. I asked him to make some recordings. The protesters were there to try to keep the forest from being cut down. Hambacher Forest sits on the edge of a huge open-pit coal mine. The energy company RWE owns the mine and the forest, and over decades it's been cutting it down to dig out the coal underneath. A few years back, climate activists built dozens of tree houses and moved in to try to protect what's left. Finally, this fall, RWE called in the police to evict them. Police used chainsaws to break through barricades and pulled activists from the trees on cherry pickers. The tree houses were destroyed, some activists went to jail, and in all the chaos, a journalist fell from a tree and died. It was ugly, and many said unnecessary. Because the thing is, Germany has already decided coal's days are numbered.
Everyone knows that we have to exit coal, and the question is now only how fast.
Patrick Grechen leads Agora Energiewende, a climate think tank in Berlin that studies the Energiewende, Germany's transition to cleaner energy sources. In some ways, the transition has been really successful. Germany now gets more than a third of its electricity from renewables. But roughly another third still comes from burning coal, and Germany has struggled to kick that habit. That's why it was a big deal when the government decided this year to come up with a deadline for a coal exit. And that's why, when RWE said it was going ahead with plans to cut down Hambacher Forest anyway, Grechen says a lot of people were surprised.
It's that contradiction of Germany being a front runner on the Energiewende, plus having established a commission on the phase out of coal, and then at the same time they keep on logging trees to get to the coal.
Forest in Germany is something that roots very deep in people's hearts.
Guido Steffen grew up around Hambacher Forest and used to ride his bike there as a child. Even he told me it's a pity to cut down the forest. And he's a spokesman for the energy company, RWE.
We know there is a coal exit.
RWE is changing to renewables too. But Steffen says Germany still needs coal. He says renewables aren't reliable enough yet. Plus, Hambacher Forest and the coal underneath it are RWE property.
I mean, we have permits. We have court cases that also stated Hambach mine is all right.
RWE made a big mistake.
That's Patrick Grechen again.
They thought at the same time, while the Coal Commission was debating about the future of coal, they could go on doing business as usual. And of course, that was the key trigger to mobilize the environmental movement in Germany.
It started slowly. Local people like Tobias and his family joining activists for a walk in the woods. But then it snowballed. Hundreds came. Then tens of thousands. By accident, Hambacher Forest became the poster child for Germany's choice about coal.
This is now a highly political topic. It's on top of the news.
Grechen says the whole country is watching and expecting a solution.
Failing would be a disaster for German politics.
The commission is supposed to come up with a final date for a coal exit by early December. Leaks to German media have talked about shutting down coal plants in 20 years or less. That's about a decade sooner than the coal industry wants, but not soon enough for environmental groups. Whatever the commission decides, for now, Hambacher Forest is safe. Last month, in an unexpected twist, a state court ruled that RWE can't cut any more trees there until 2020 at the earliest. In the meantime, the standoff is back on.
Last month, 20,000 coal workers marched in support of the mine. Days later, 6,000 activists blocked a coal train. And on a recent sunny Sunday, hundreds of people rode bikes 25 miles out to the forest, carrying flags that said "Stop coal and save the trees." Since Germany's plans for a coal exit put Hambacher Forest in the spotlight, in some ways, everything has changed. But you can also say nothing has. Activists are back, pitching tents and hanging protest banners. Just a few hundred yards away, RWE is still mining coal. And here, in the shade of oak trees, three guys are hammering away at a new treehouse. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Hambacher Forest, Germany.
The fight over coal in Germany comes down in part to how quickly we move to fight climate change. For tens of thousands of people in California, we can't move quickly enough. You heard here yesterday how climate change is playing a big role in the fires that are devastating parts of that state. Again, we also heard yesterday from a distraught Ellen Vandenberg as she fled the fire in Paradise, California, with her baby son. We wanted to see how she's doing today.
I'm staying with my husband's mother. We're about an hour and a half south near the Sacramento area.
And your five-month-old son, how's he doing?
You know, he handles everything pretty well. When I was driving down, when everything was really crazy, he just sort of got really calm and just, he put his little arms around me and, you know, he kind of turned his head sideways and put it on my chest and he just hung out, you know?
Yeah. Do you have any idea what happened to your family's house?
I don't. I mean, I don't have any real hope that my house is there. It's hard to be upset about my little house and all my little things that I've collected over my lifetime when everybody lost everything. You know, it's almost like the scale of it is so big that it's hard to say, you know, oh, I really loved that thing.
That must be hard, though, to kind of find yourself in that mindset.
It is. It is. What happened to me was a lot for me. You know, I feel guilty about not being able to have done more. You know, why didn't I grab somebody and put them in my car? There were people that didn't make it. There were people that were running on the side of the road. You know, it's like, yeah. It's kind of hard to wrap my head around.
I know there's a lot of relief efforts going on, GoFundMe campaigns. Have you been benefiting from any of this?
I have, yes. A friend did a GoFundMe page for us, and I am just floored at how much support has been pouring in. I mean, and then the other thing is, when I went down to Chico, we went down to the Walmart parking lot, and there were just hundreds of people helping. Hundreds of people. And food trucks and clothing and bags of, people approaching us saying, hey, are you from Paradise? What do you need? I feel, you know, honored that people are so willing to do anything to help us.
Ellen Vandenberg, resident of Paradise, California. Thank you very much. It's good to speak with you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
I'm Marco Werman. A new recording doesn't directly implicate Saudi Arabia's crown prince in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, but it comes close. A Saudi dissident tells us what that means for her.
I feel safer now because I doubt whether Mohammed bin Salman would like to have another scandal on a global scale.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There is potentially significant news out of the Middle East today, a possible ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas. Hamas controls the Gaza Strip, and over the last few days, the two sides looked like they were heading toward another all-out war. It's still not clear if a new ceasefire would hold. The World's Matthew Bell reports there's pressure on both sides to take a hard line.
Up until Sunday, things were going relatively well in the Gaza Strip. Egypt had helped broker a deal over the past year that was starting to bear fruit. Tens of millions of dollars from Qatar was flowing into Gaza to provide months of back pay for civil servants and for desperately needed electricity. Life for many Gazans was looking up.
Until Sunday evening, when a special Israeli unit infiltrated into the Gaza Strip and clashed out with Al-Qassam Brigade, the military wing of Hamas.
Mukhaymer Abusada teaches political science at Al-Azhar University in Gaza. In the shooting that followed, 7 Palestinians were killed, including a Hamas military commander. The Israeli officer in command of that unit was killed as well. Abusada says things only escalated from there.
The next day, Hamas decided to retaliate against this Israeli infiltration by shooting a Cornet anti-tank missile against an Israeli bus.
That's sound from a YouTube video released by Hamas showing the attack on the Israeli bus on Monday. One Israeli soldier was injured in that explosion. Since then, Israeli jets have bombed more than 150 targets in the Gaza Strip, and Palestinian militants have fired more than 450 rockets and mortars into Israel. Israel and Hamas have gone to war 3 times since Hamas took control of Gaza in 2007, but Abusada says despite the events of recent days, the leaders on both sides seem to want to avoid another war.
Even though the situation has been escalated, and this is the worst escalation between Hamas and Israel since the Israeli offensive in the summer of 2014, I still believe that the situation has not gotten out of control. And there is a lot of room for Egypt and the UN to intervene and broker a new ceasefire between Hamas and Israel.
Later on Tuesday, there was talk of just that. Hamas said it was possible to return to a ceasefire if Israeli aggression stopped, and an Israeli official confirmed that a ceasefire agreement had been reached. But soon after that, Israeli ministers started lining up against the idea of stopping the airstrikes against Hamas just yet. That's opposition leader Yair Lapid. He accused Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of surrendering to Hamas. He mentioned the residents of southern Israel who've been targeted by Palestinian rockets and suggested that the bombing in Gaza should continue. Ofer Zaltzberg is an analyst based in Jerusalem with the International Crisis Group. He says it's clear that both Hamas and the Netanyahu government want to avoid another war, but they both face strong political opposition at home.
Public opinions on both sides are very hostile to the very notion of cooperation. There is also a lot of mistrust and continuing military activities by Israel against Hamas, both in terms of intelligence collection and other things. And there are groups within Gaza who still would like to act militarily against Israel. This makes the cooperation much more difficult. It's very hard to cooperate and fight simultaneously.
Zaltzberg says cooperation is only going to get more difficult as time goes on because the ceasefire is one part of a larger process of negotiations. Hamas has signaled a willingness to ease tensions with Israel in return for the lifting of the blockade of the Gaza Strip, but it faces pressure from rival Palestinian factions. And Israel is looking at a national election coming up in 2019, and political leaders there will be tempted to talk tough on Gaza. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Last month, just minutes after Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, one of the men involved in his assassination made a call to his superior. The man told the official to tell your boss that the mission had been carried out. That account by the New York Times comes from people who've heard a recording of the aftermath of the killing obtained by Turkish intelligence. Saudi scholar Madawi Al-Rashid teaches at the London School of Economics. She says there's little doubt what the speaker meant by tell your boss.
There's no point in thinking that somebody else in the intelligence services or other princes had ordered this operation, simply because for the last 2 years, all powers in Saudi Arabia are concentrated in the hand of the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And he has his team prepared for these kind of operations.
I know you've been an outspoken opponent of the Saudi regime. You're now in London, but are you worried for your own safety? Or do you know if you're on a list?
I have no idea if I'm on the list, but most probably I have been put on some kind of list. I have been threatened before a long time ago when I started writing. And at one point, the Saudi ambassador in Paris conveyed a message to my father at the time to say that if I continued to publish, and it was a book that I was planning to publish entitled A History of Saudi Arabia, if I continue with the project and publish it, they will take disciplinary action. However, at the moment, I think Jamal Khashoggi paid with his life, and I feel safer now because I doubt whether Mohammed bin Salman would like to have another scandal on a global scale. In fact, I think this crisis after the murder of Khashoggi made quite a lot of Saudi dissidents abroad, asylum seekers in the US, in Canada, and here in London safer. However, in the Arab world, it is possible that he will be able to reach the ones he put on the blacklist.
So your sense that this goes all the way to the top is supported by something else that we learned this week, that top Saudi intelligence officials close to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman talked with a group of businessmen last year about using private companies to assassinate their enemies in Iran. It's kind of extraordinary. What do we know about those discussions?
There are plans that had been discussed, but they were delayed as Mohammed bin Salman thought that it is better to wait for the American elections of President Donald Trump and later reveal what his plans are and perhaps discuss them with the U.S. administration. And I wouldn't be surprised if Mohammed bin Salman wanted to target certain individuals in Iran. But that is difficult, a different situation from targeting your own citizens abroad, such as Jamal Khashoggi.
So what do you think is the way forward? Do you think Mohammed bin Salman's wings have been clipped by the aftermath of the assassination? Will Washington and Riyadh go back to business as usual in the aftermath of this?
I do not envisage that business as usual will be the right option for the U.S. administration. This sort of unconditional support for MBS has to stop. And I only think that Congress could perhaps stop this in terms of making it difficult for the president to order arms sales to Saudi Arabia without those being checked and without conditions attached.
So a CIA director, Gina Haspel, heard an audio tape of Khashoggi's killing in Ankara. She apparently briefed the president on this. Will there be any space left for anybody to deny what happened?
A lot of people at this stage know exactly what happened. They are just holding on to this information, whether it is Turkey or the U.S., Britain, and Canada. And the reason why they're holding on to them is perhaps trying to find a face-saving policy that would not directly condemn Mohammed bin Salman. But I think these countries who have the audio tapes have a moral responsibility to the world, to the journalists, to the family of Khashoggi, to make this public.
So one last thing. If Jamal Khashoggi's body is missing, which a lot of evidence seems to point to that, I mean, what does that mean for his family, for Saudis?
It is devastating for his children, for his fiancée, to dissolve the body as alleged, as reported in the media. Is a horrific act. And in Islamic culture, it is very, very difficult to keep Jamal Khashoggi in limbo. He's disappeared, he's murdered, but there is no body and no real funeral can take place to just simply put an end to the grief of his family who do not know where his body is at the moment.
Madawi Al-Rashid teaches at the London School of Economics. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Mohammed bin Salman and the other royals in Saudi Arabia have long been the target of Saudi activists. The activists used to rely heavily on Twitter to express their opposition to the monarch's policies. One of Saudi Arabia's leading activists now says that strategy has run its course. Manal al-Sharif used Twitter to help spark her campaign to win Saudi women the right to drive. Now she says she's done with Twitter.
I drove a car. And from my actions, the authorities sent the secret police to my house in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. when driving for women was banned.
Okay.
So I drove a car. I posted that on YouTube. It went viral. And the authorities didn't like that. They sent the secret police to arrest me in the middle of the night. Someone knew where I lived, one of the neighbors. He also had a Twitter account. He came and he was tweeting live minute by minute what happened. Otherwise, in such countries, you just go missing quietly and no one knows about you. So I do have a personal Twitter at that time.
Yeah, and to your friend Omar, who was so brave to live tweet what was going on. What happened to Omar?
He asked me to remove the link to his Twitter account because the trolls started following him now and harassing him now, 7 years later. And that tells you something. That tells you that we really lost our battle when it comes to using Twitter to push for social change and human rights in my country.
So social media platforms, they were a big help for Saudi activists, at least initially. I know Saudi Arabia took to Twitter with more enthusiasm than anywhere else in the Arab world, but the government of Saudi Arabia, they kind of got wise to you. What did they start to do?
When they saw how effective it is, they just took over because that's how they conduct their surveillance, collect information about people. The state found that they can manipulate or they can direct millions of tweets of conversation on Twitter. So that made it very clear to the state that they can play with that, the hashtags. They can play with creating a lot of fake and malicious accounts.
So it sounds like the more civilians in Saudi Arabia started using social media and Twitter specifically, the more the government Yes. pushed back and shaped and molded Twitter in their own vision.
If you look at the week, Jamal Khashoggi was...
So the week that Khashoggi week, disappeared finally, October 2nd?
Back into October, when they finally confessed on October 16, if you look at the trending hashtags, that exact week, it was, I am Arab and Mohammed bin Salman represents me. That was telling me that we lost it. Those trends that I see in front of me being controlled by such pro-government trolls and bots. And that's the week that I just am like, I'm not part of this anymore.
This perhaps shouldn't be a surprise to us because I know your own experience on Twitter changed dramatically last year with the arrival of something known as the electronic flies. What happened
yes.
there?
Those are people paid. They pay them to run hundreds of accounts under one person, one individual. And those accounts, they harass, intimidate, and spread false news and also pro-government news in Saudi Arabia.
Now, I have to ask you one more thing, Manal. You recently deleted your Twitter account. It meant disconnecting from your nearly 300,000 followers, though, and that means your voice is now lost to hundreds of thousands of Saudi Arabians. Why not stay in the conversation and fight the propaganda? You're safely out of the country.
Interesting question. I stayed in the conversation for 7 years. Using Twitter is not effective because you are not in the conversation. You're flushed out of the conversation. You're intimidated every day. You receive death threats every day. You want to keep your mental health. So they use it to play these psychological games on activists by intimidating, spreading fear. And that's why I don't want to be part of that. I open now. I'm learning how to do vlogging. So I already opened my YouTube channel. And I'm going to start using that to speak up. They should be afraid, not us.
So you found that Twitter's downsides actually have overtaken its upsides?
Unfortunately, yes.
Manal Al-Sharif, a Saudi women's rights activist, speaking with us from New York. Very good to meet you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Same here.
7-Eleven is the convenience store for many people. Countless locations, many of them open round the clock. But there's a secret war behind the scenes. The 7-Eleven company versus 7-Eleven franchise owners. The company's been accused of using underhanded tactics in this war. One example, turning franchises into targets in President Trump's immigration crackdown. Last January, 98 stores across the country were raided by Immigration and Customs Enforcement on the same day. ICE agents demanded workers' documentation and made several arrests. Michael Smith of Bloomberg Businessweek says raids of 7-Eleven stores have continued on a smaller scale since then. I asked him how ICE got involved.
Well, it's hard to say, but what we do know is that as far back as 2010, ICE and the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, in this case, launched a major investigation into the company, which, by the way, 7-Eleven is a franchise company. It means every store is independently operated. And they found egregious violations of human trafficking laws and also immigration law. So that kind of put the company in the federal government spotlight to a big degree because of the information the feds gathered in their investigation, you know, 7-8 years ago. At that time, 7-Eleven Inc., the parent company, turned over payroll records for almost all its stores to the federal government. And we have sources close to the company that say that the government has probably been mining that data ever since. So it's relatively easy for them to target specific stores with these kind of operations.
What you just described there does seem like it's part of the tension between the 7-Eleven company and its franchises. It goes back a ways, this history. What is the conflict and how long has this been going on?
For the large part of the last decade, there's been intense conflict, like you say, between the corporation 7-Eleven, which is owned by a Japanese company, and its stores, which are basically its customers. And the tension revolves around the corporation's intent, basically, to get a larger and larger share of the revenue that each store delivers. So there's been all kinds of pushback from the store owners. They've sued the company multiple times. The company has sued them multiple times. And there's just been this really dirty campaign by the corporation intended to sort of get rid of the outspoken critics of the corporation. It's a really nasty fight, and immigration has sort of been at the center of it.
Yeah, I mean, there have been some pretty aggressive tactics that corporate has used against franchises in the past, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Some of the lawsuits that franchisees have filed read like spy novels. You have a company that has created a pretty significant private force of private investigators to investigate wrongdoing in stores. And they use tactics like surveillance vans disguised as plumber's trucks, mobile GPS units that they use to track people, and just surveillance teams that targeted specific store owners that they felt shouldn't be a part of the 7-Eleven franchise. In one case, a franchisee sued the company. You know, one of their investigators was trailing him, and he claims that the guy tried to run him down, and that suit was settled by 7-Eleven. It's just almost unbelievable some of the tactics you can read about in this litigation.
And is the overall aim here by corporate to extract more profit from the franchisees?
Well, it's hard to say what their aim really is, but their strategy has effectively done that. And there are multiple things that store owners have to comply with. And if they don't comply with those, they can be cited. And if you get enough citations for seemingly minor things, in some cases, the company can actually take your store away and they don't have to pay you any money in compensation. So it's serious business for the store operators and for the corporation. There's just this really antagonistic relationship where you have some pretty independent-minded and independently operated store owners that are pushing back and opposing some of these measures and trying to negotiate a better deal. And a lot of those same store owners have had their stores taken away. And there's a battle going in the courts in Chicago where 7-Eleven basically seized all 8 stores of probably one of the most vocal franchisees in the country who'd been highly critical of the company and its policies. And they went in and seized them. And in their argument for seizing those stores, they cited raids on this particular store owner's stores by ICE. So it's a central part of their legal argument to get those stores back.
Michael, in your research for Bloomberg, you found personnel shifts over the years at 7-Eleven. They had a CEO, James Keyes, and he seemed to defend the immigrant owners of 7-Eleven. Then this new CEO steps in, Joe DePinto, and he seems to be more rigorous on immigration and seizing franchises where the owners are not following the rules. Is this personality shift at 7-Eleven crucial to kind of understanding why these raids are happening?
Well, that's what a lot of the franchisees say. The previous CEO celebrated the sort of immigrant legacy of the company. You got to understand, 7-Eleven really is seen as the way to realize the American dream by many of the store owners, and thousands of them bought into the franchise in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, believing that this was their way to really make it in America. I mean, you hear that time and time again. Mm. And the company celebrated that. They held one of their birthday celebrations for the corporation at Ellis Island, just to bring that home. And you're right, the CEO that took over in the mid-2000s, Joe DePinto, he's an Army vet, and he's, you know, he likes military precision, according to people that have worked with him. And that has sort of come down the wrong way for some of the franchisees, and they feel like 7-Eleven is sort of helping rat out store owners to immigration and to the government to try to get rid of them. 7-Eleven, of course, denies this.
As you say, 7-Eleven is this kind of totem of the American dream. It's also one of the most recognized American brands on the planet. I mean, you find them in Indonesia to Iceland. I gather there's 67,000 plus 7-Elevens around the world now. But with the anti-immigrant tone at 7-Eleven, what's this going to do to its reputation and bottom line? What are you hearing?
The franchisees say that it's really, really difficult to make a decent living running one of these stores. And I had many who had franchises for 10, 20 years saying, if I could do it again, if I were getting into the business now, I would never buy one of these franchises because you just cannot make money if you comply with the rules like you should. Mm. The economics don't work. So it's unclear what impact that's having. Right now, the company is requiring everyone to sign a new agreement that the store owners say will take even more of their money and make it even harder to turn a profit and make a living. There's huge numbers of stores that are up for sale. People are just trying to get out. What that means in the future for the company, I don't really know. But it's clearly a difficult business model these days.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek reporter Michael Smith. Before we go today, a few words from Stan Lee. The brains behind the spirit of Marvel Comics left us yesterday at the age of 95. Right after the news broke, a video of Lee started making the rounds online. He recorded it just over a year ago in the wake of the white supremacist violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. Here's a moment from that video where Lee reminds us what made his superhero story special.
Those stories have room for everyone, regardless of their race, gender, religion, or color of their skin. The only things we don't have room for are hatred, intolerance, and bigotry. That man next to you, he's your brother. That woman over there, she's your sister. And that kid walking by, hey, who knows? He may have the proportionate strength of a spider. We're all part of one big family. The human family.
You don't even need a cape to be a part of that family. The late Stan Lee there speaking in a video he put out last year. Great to hear his voice again today. Any day, really. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.